David Gessner wants to change the way people write about nature. Instead of stereotypic stories about wild animals in pristine landscapes, he advocates a style of nature writing that's messy, raucous even, and includes an often overlooked animal, people. Gessner's latest book, My Green Manifesto, is an example of this new movement in nature writing. It's the story of a kayak trip he took down Boston's Charles River with his friend Dan Driscoll, a guy who spent years trying to clean up the river. And Strange Champs asked Gessner to read a passage from the book.
We paddle quietly for a while on the green, shadowy river. I listen as Dan launches into the first of the morning's monologues. Nature is my religion, he begins. He talks in this vein for a while, but when his words start snaking their way to the topics of activism and politics, they become bold and original. We nature lovers are hypocrites, of course, he says. We're all hypocrites. None of us are consistent. We worry that if we fight for nature, people will say, but you drive a car, or you fly a lot, or you're a consumer too, and that stops us in our tracks. It's almost as if admitting that we are hypocrites lets people off the hook. I pull my paddle out of the water to listen. What we need are more hypocrites, he says. We need hypocrites who aren't afraid of admitting it, but will still fight for the environment. We don't need some sort of pure movement run by pure people. We need hypocrites. I think of Ed Abbey fighting for the West while throwing empty beer cans out the window of his truck. I think of my own environmental Achilles heel, a dainty preference for hot baths over showers, not nearly as cool as Abbey's boozing, but possibly as wasteful. And then I think of everyone I know and can't come up with anyone who has an entirely clean eco-slate, which seems to mean that logically, Dan is right. If only non-hypocrites are going to fight for the environment, then it will be an army of none.
David, is this something you worry about personally, whether your own lifestyle measures up to your environmental beliefs?
I do worry about it. I come from a background of excess. A big family of big spenders and big eaters and big drinkers. When I first read Walden, the love of beautiful places resonated. What resonated less was this kind of frugality and pulling back and restraint, which just temperamentally wasn't a good fit for me.
So the subtitle of your book is Down the Charles River in Pursuit of a New Environmentalism. Sounds like you're beginning to suggest that we need an environmentalism that's less pure, more full of contradictions?
Yeah, you know, what we need is an environmentalism that's openly not afraid of being occasionally hypocritical, a limited environmentalism, a sloppier environmentalism, hopefully a funnier environmentalism. I mean, we all know the different nature languages. There's the nature saint. Oh, a squirrel, an acorn, how beautiful, how wonderful. And there's the technocrat kind of a semi-palmated plover, which migrates through in late October, you know. And then, worst of all for me, is the end-of-the-world school of just doom, where, no, you know, I say it's like living with a spouse who's always saying, this marriage is over, this marriage is doomed. And it's not that I disagree with the premise, because I realize population is rising, species are dying. I mean, the world is becoming more crowded and smeared with our industrial stains. It's true. But what I object to is kind of the result of focusing so much on the doom, which is the intellectual equivalent of a panic attack. You feel overwhelmed and you don't do anything. We become paralyzed. And the way out is by simple single actions. And that's why I put Dan Driscoll, who greened the Charles River, as kind of a hero, because he didn't save the world. He saved a small part of it.
So tell us about Dan Driscoll, this guy whose conversation you just quoted in that section you read. He emerges in your book as a kind of modern-day eco-hero. Who is he, and what is it you admire so much about him?
Well, I met him in an unlikely way. I played Ultimate Frisbee for years, and there was this kind of crazy guy who we called Danimal, and he was known for racing after Frisbees, I said, like a border collie, and diving after them, and he was very full of gusto. And one night, drinking beers with him after we played, I realized that he had spent the last 20 years fighting to green the Charles River. It seemed a very unlikely guy to have done it when I first met him.
This is the river that runs through the heart of Boston.
Exactly. It runs from about where the marathon starts in Hopkinton right into Boston. It wends around. And Dan had taken a job as an eco-advisor for the state, working for the state in Massachusetts. And he had been the new guy, and they'd given him basically an impossible task. They'd said, you go reclaim this land along the Charles, and you clean up the Middle Charles. And, of course, the Charles River is so famously dirty, the Standells had a song, Dirty Water, about it, that they sing at Red Sox games. And Dan didn't know that he was given an impossible task, and he started in on it. What he was trying to do was reclaim land that had once been the state's. People thought they owned this land, that Dan was coming to tell them, no, in fact, the city owns it, and we're going to take it back. Just imagine the fury. You know, not in my backyard. He literally was trying to take their backyards from them. He had a legal team that he didn't use, not a single lawsuit. It was through town meetings, through cajoling, through schmoozing, that he managed to talk towns into putting bike paths along the Charles. And bike paths were kind of his Trojan horse for putting in native plantings and replanting the banks.
But it's really interesting that you write about this kind of eco-hero in your book when you also say that you're not sure you really want to be this thing called an environmentalist.
Yeah, I know what I do want to be. You know, if you look at Thoreau, who everybody drags out for everything, and I do too, I'm as guilty as anybody. I went back to Walden with my wife and daughter a couple of years ago. My daughter was about 6. And we walked along the pond, Walden Pond, and my wife pointed and where the foundation, where the cabin had been, and she said to my daughter, that's where the house was of the man who ruined Daddy's life. And, you know, and it's true.
And
when I was 16, I read that book. You know, something changed. I was like, it wasn't that it was a literary thing. It confirmed an instinct in me, almost an animal instinct, that I loved those places and I loved mucking around in them and I loved being out in them. And it was a very kind of primal thing. And what frustrates me about environmentalism is we talk about laws and rules and we neglect that initial Thoreauvian impulse of kind of wildness.
It sounds like you think we've tamed Thoreau, kind of turned him into a PBS nature special and environmentalism along with it. And what we need is something more akin to, I don't know, the energy or the anarchy of hip hop or the punk movement.
Yeah, anybody who spent time more than a day or two out in the outdoors knows that around a campfire, usually with some sort of bottle that you're drinking from, you have some of the most raucous, fun, and funny times in your life, and you bond with people. And it's not pristine and it's not sweet. It's more like embracive of the whole. What I like to try to do, and what I've tried to do in my own life, is mess things up.
I'm wondering if one of the things you're suggesting is that in order to get more wildness into our environmental ideals, maybe we need to go on a kind of quest in search of more personal interior wildness. And
I'm
wondering what that would look like, what that would mean in practice.
Well, you're right. I think the corresponding wildness is an emotional state. It's an openness and vulnerability. In the book, I say the misconception is we have to go to Everest to have a wild moment. And then I bring up two moments in my life that were the wildest moments I have ever had. The first was the death of my dad, where I was holding his hand and I could feel his heart pulsing. He was pretty young. It seems younger now that I've turned 50. He was 56. You know, he died while I was holding his hand. I hadn't experienced such an uprising kind of wild feeling in me. I didn't experience it again until many years later when my daughter was born and I was there. And I remember beforehand all my friends saying, oh, your life's about to change. The implication being that it would become tamer. And in fact, that was the wildest moment I ever remember. It's a C-section and, you know, I say she came out bloody and triumphant. Having a child has continued to be a very wild thing if you're open to the animal aspects of it. I remember one time Hadley had some milk encrusted on her face. She was probably like 1 or 2, and my wife licked it off, and I thought, ah, yes, there's there's what we need. You know, this memory that we're animals too, which with it brings humility.
Well, I want to end by asking you to read just a little bit more from your book, the chapter called Henry's River.
Sure.
And this is on page 183.
Let's get down to a simple question, a question befitting an address to graduating seniors. Here it is. What is the meaning of life? Let's start with one of Thoreau's answers. It's fairly straightforward. Fall in love with the world. But how does this translate into practical action? Maybe through the oldest form of recreation, the activity I'm engaged in at this very moment, walking. I should point out I do a lot of my writing into microcassette recorder while I'm strolling. I'm sorry, but isn't that where a lot of it starts? With apologies to the yogis who are reading this, most of us don't have a taste for sitting still. Wandering off for no apparent reason may not have the environmental zing of low-carbon cars, but it too serves a purpose, even if that purpose sometimes seems purposeless. First of all, it's the best way to see the world, and I'm convinced that for most of us, it's when we think best, when our feet are connected to the ground. Thoreau said of going for a walk, if you are ready to leave father and mother, and brother and sister, and wife and child and friends, and never see them again, if you have paid your debts and made your will and settled all your affairs, and you are a free man, then you are ready for a walk. What the hell does that mean? It means that we spend the better part of our lives trying to be logical, trying to be practical, trying to follow through on our commitments and checking things off our list. But that sometimes, maybe once a day, we need to launch ourselves out the door and head to a place, both physical and mental, that we can call our own.
That's David Gessner reading from his book, My Green Manifesto, Down the Charles River in Pursuit of a New Environmentalism. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps.